Welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. 2012 has arrived with a bang, the kind of bang that comes with presidential election years. The Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary kick off the selection process that produces each party's candidate for November's general election. Today, we'll visit with our county clerk, Larry Kestenbaum, and learn the procedures, the lingo, and the impact of these early races. What is the difference between a caucus and a primary? Do I have to belong to a party to participate? And why do Iowa and New Hampshire always get to go first? Joining me today in the WEMU studio is our Washtenaw County Clerk, Larry Kestenbaum. Like Superman, Larry has two lives. As our mild-mannered clerk, he oversees elections, vital records, and every manner of administrative minutiae. But like Clark Kent, Kestenbaum also has a secret superhero life. He is a historical trivia expert par excellence, and in his non-public service life, he catalogs all manner of political ephemera on his very popular blog, Political Graveyard. Larry, thanks for being here today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's always fun to have you here. People are now, the new year has started, we're into a presidential year, and now we're looking at primaries and caucuses. We've just had the Iowa caucuses, we're headed toward the New Hampshire primary. And the first thing I want to talk about is the difference between a primary and a caucus.
Yeah, that's actually a critical distinction when it comes to Iowa and New Hampshire, because Iowa is allowed to go ahead of New Hampshire by virtue of being a caucus. If it was a primary, then New Hampshire would try to leapfrog them. With a caucus, you have a process that's run not by the local governments and as an official election, but by the party. Typically, it involves people voting or gathering in particular areas, not normal polling places, but perhaps gymnasiums and so forth. Not necessarily a secret ballot, and not necessarily a direct reflection of how people vote. In the Republican caucuses that were just held, they actually did tally the votes that people put in. People would write down, it was all write-in. You had to write the name of the candidate you were supporting, and those votes were counted. In the Democratic side, the caucuses, they gather in a group, and then the supporters of each candidate would go into a different corner and so forth. And if they are less than 15%, and they are given the opportunity to join a different one. Because the threshold for getting any credit for being there is 15%. And so the totals of how many people supported in the last one, John Edwards or Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, that was really very difficult to determine depending on, who had how much support in each particular room.
Well, let's go back to that because Albert Einstein said politics is more difficult than physics, and I think when it comes to Iowa, that may be true. So what you're saying is that the two parties in Iowa both use caucuses,
yes,
but they administer them differently.
They do.
So you have a private ballot or a secret ballot in the Republican caucus, but in the Democratic caucus, people are moving, changing places, designating whom they support based on where they stand.
Exactly.
And once people have this information, what do they do with it?
Yeah, the basic process. I mean, the fundamental thing is there's a convention, which is the body that actually has the power to nominate the candidates, the presidential, vice presidential candidates. And so there's two tasks here. There's the task of choosing who the delegates will be to that convention, and perhaps less critically for them, but more critically for the whether they're pledged to a particular candidate, such that when they get to the convention, they have to vote for the candidate who they've been designated as being a delegate for.
So, now when you're talking about the convention, you're talking about the state convention or the national convention?
No, in this case, the national convention.
And each state has a designated number of seats at the national convention?
That's right.
Okay, so in Iowa last week, they were choosing, they were taking essentially a poll to find out whom was the preferred candidate, but they were also selecting the people that were going to be casting the Iowa Republicans' votes at the national convention.
I think that there are successive steps, and that the numbers from the preference from the caucuses are used ultimately to allocate delegates. Nowadays, the issue of how the delegates are pledged is not so critical because the delegates are actually chosen pretty much by the presidential campaign. And so if, let's say, the Rick Santorum campaign or the John Edwards campaign put someone there who's going to be a loyalist to that candidate. And so there's not really any question about how they're going to vote.
Okay. So caucuses, they are party elections. They are administered by the party. Let's contrast that with primaries.
Yeah, a primary is an election that's held, you know, by the government, by the state and local governments in a particular area, held in the same way as electing a mayor or a presidential election, where the ballots are the standard ballots and the rules are the rules that are they're enacted by that state under state law. And the state constitution as to how elections are supposed to be operated and what the rules are. Idea of having a primary election to nominate candidates for the general election came out of the progressive era in the early 20th century when, as a reaction against the control of nominations by political bosses up to that time and well after that time, in fact, and the idea being that you could have the voters make the selection of who the candidates were would be the Democratic candidate, the Republican candidate, and even, you know, they had primaries in those days even for minor parties, although they would usually not have contests. This didn't work all that well at the outset, but people have become used to it. So with the presidential candidates, unlike a primary, let's say, for mayor or a primary for sheriff. In this case, you're not electing anyone directly. You're voting for the candidate such that they would get an allocated share of the delegates for that in that state for that for the upcoming presidential nominating convention.
Okay, this is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU, and my guest today is Washtenaw County Clerk Larry Kestenbaum, who also writes the popular blog Political Graveyard. Okay, so primaries are elections run by the government. But some states have partisan requirements for participation, right?
Right. It varies from state to state, but in many states, probably the majority of states, in order to vote in a primary, you either have to register, when you register to vote, as a member of that party or as an adherent to that party, such that if you say that you're a Republican, you'll get the Republican primary ballot. If you say you're a Democrat, you'll get the Democratic primary ballot. If you say you're an independent, you'll get neither. In some states, there was a long, you know, durational requirement. You had to have changed your, you know, set your party preference up long before the election, even a year before the election or 6 months before the election. Those requirements have been struck down. But the 30 days is very typical. I think 45 days is the limit. And the effect of that is that when you go to vote, when you vote in the primary, you're identifying with a party by voting in its primary. You're known as a registered Republican or a registered Democrat or a person who took the Democratic or the Republican ballot at a primary. Michigan is one of the relatively few states that is completely different from that. In Michigan, you get a ballot normally in most primaries in Michigan with both parties' candidates on the same ballot, and you, in the privacy of the voting booth, you choose which party's primary to participate in. You can't do both.
Right. You can't go back and forth and say, right, I like the Democrat here and I like this Republican over here.
Right. You basically have to go in and essentially be partisan and vote only one party's for one party's candidates. If in one election you want to vote in the Republican primary, you can do that, and then the Democratic primary in the next election, but you can't vote, you know, both primaries at the same time.
Now, when it comes to caucuses, obviously the parties could put any limitations on participation that they wanted, right?
That's right. That's right.
And the government can't step in and direct them in particular ways.
Right. In fact, when it comes to the nominating process, the court decisions have been moving in the direction of giving the parties more authority over this, that the state does not have, in effect, the authority to tell the parties what to do in terms of their nominating process. So, for example, with the presidential primary in Michigan, what has frequently happened is that the Democrats have opted out of the primary. And so there's still a Democratic primary in the ballot because the state law has provided for it, but it's not part of the process, not part of the nominating process at all. The Democrats have used, in Michigan, have used caucuses instead.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a phenomenon in primaries that gets set up raiding, where you have a situation where you may have one party having a hotly contested primary, the other one having a not-so-hotly contested primary, whether you're dealing with a presidential primary or for other offices, and that's crossover voting. There's sort of almost a mythology around this about how effective it is. Do you think it happens? Do you think it has influenced elections in Michigan?
I think that it happens to an extent. I think it happens when, I mean, it makes a difference when there's a lot of participation, a lot of people who simultaneously have the incentive to do that. Normally, it's just a handful of activists, who will, again, secretly vote in the other party's primary, perhaps to vote for, a candidate who they would prefer to have opposing them, or maybe a candidate they prefer to vote for in the general election, depending on the circumstances. But the general idea is that in most cases, those folks would be deterred from crossing over if they had to be publicly identified as having voted in the other party's primary.
Well, in some ways, you would be. I mean, if you have a presidential primary where the Democrats, for example, are not participating, and you have people who are traditionally Democratic activists who come into the primary and get a ballot. It's pretty clear what's going on, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But in this upcoming primary in Michigan on February 28th, there will be a choice. It'll be a choice of ballot primary. This is something we see only in presidential primaries in Michigan, where when you go to vote, you will be given the choice of selecting a Democratic or Republican ballot for the presidential primary. If you get a Democratic ballot, you'll have the choice between Barack Obama and uncommitted. If you get a Republican ballot, you'll have a list of all the various candidates who have been talked about, have been selected by the Secretary of State. The effect of that is that if you're it'll be on record which one you chose. And in general, activists are not interested in being identified as having crossed over.
Oh, it's now going to be. Even if I go in February, and I say I want a Democratic ballot, then they're going to keep track of that now.
Right.
And so my voting record will show that I voted in a Democratic primary.
Yeah, and not necessarily the local voting record that will be retained with the local clerk, but it will be on a record which will not be. There's no attempt to keep it secret.
It's public.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go back, though, to two races which have sort of taken on, as I said, almost mythological status here in Michigan. One is that Republican votes propelled Jeffrey Feiger into the Democratic nomination against John Engler. And the second one is that Democratic raiding took the Michigan primary away from George W. Bush in an effort to embarrass Governor Engler. What do you say about those two things?
Well, as to the Feiger race, I was around for that, and I can tell you that the supporters of the other two candidates were relatively dispirited. Feiger was the only one who was raising much enthusiasm, even though he seemed like a very offbeat candidate to nominate. I think that a lot of people down in the grassroots were, at the time of the primary, found him more appealing.
Sort of a populist.
More populist. And people were telling me, UAW guys saying down on the shop floor, Feiger is very popular. So I don't believe that Republicans were responsible for Feiger's victory. He won easily, The other two candidates, had they gotten together and had one candidate against him, it might have been different. But with the opposition split and again not terribly enthusiastic about either one, I think that was what happened there. So I wouldn't describe that as an example of what you may call raiding. The other example, though, when John Engler, as governor, promised that George W. Bush would win Michigan in the primary.
He would be the firewall.
Yes, that would be the firewall for George W. Bush, and instead the state went for McCain. I think there is a pretty good argument that there were a lot of Democrats who supplementing the regular McCain voters among the Republicans to put McCain over the top in that.
Today I'm talking with Washtenaw County Clerk Larry Kestenbaum. We're talking about the presidential primary season, the Iowa caucus, the state primaries that are coming up in the near future. Primaries are a different kind of election than the caucuses, but do insiders have a edge on caucuses as opposed to primaries? In other words, even though you bring the party faithful together, is it orchestrated in a way that keeps the decision within the hands of the powerful?
It can be, although I think that there is, because the caucus typically involves a much smaller number of people participating, it's sometimes been the case that outsiders have come along, bringing in lots of new folks
by bus.
Yes, who might not otherwise have participated, and in effect take over the process. And that has happened repeatedly across recent history. And so the caucuses are viewed as more controllable by the people who are the status quo, the powers that be. But the primary, throwing it open for people to vote statewide in a primary is a little bit more stable and predictable, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Now, we were talking about the fact that in many states you have to announce a political affiliation in order to participate in that party's primary. In Michigan, you can't pick and choose. You can either get a Democratic ballot or a Republican ballot.
Only in the presidential primary.
In the presidential primary. But in California, they have a unique ballot, a general ballot, not necessarily the presidential ballot. But how is it that they can do that? And
right.
Explain what happens there and how is it they can do it?
Well, this was passed in a statewide referendum. Obviously, California is known for having lots of ballot proposals every election. And some states have experimented with different ways of doing elections. Louisiana already has something like this. But in effect, you have all the candidates of both parties or all parties running in a primary, and then the top two would be advanced to the general election in November. And the top two, depending on the district or the constituency or the candidates, the top two might be of the same party. They might be different parties. They might not necessarily be of the major parties. And the parties themselves tend to be opposed to this because if you have, let's say, two Democrats running for Congress in the same district for the same seat, then that's going to interfere with party unity for other offices and so forth. The parties have an incentive to get everybody together moving in the same direction. At the same time, you have the argument that you want to have the critical vote. For example, if it's an overwhelmingly Democratic or overwhelmingly Republican district, the real decision is made in the primary. If you move that decision to November, then a lot more people can take part in it.
So what really California is saying is they're saying, well, we don't see the general election as necessarily between a Democrat and a Republican or a Democrat and a Republican and a Green candidate. We're essentially going to let everybody run on the same ballot, and the voters are going to pick the top two.
Right.
Is there another argument to be made, in other words, from a partisan position?
Right.
I'll take that, which is we're trying to choose, in the Democratic Party, we're trying to choose the Democrat who will carry the party banner.
Right.
How come California can say, no, we're not going to let you do that?
Well, they may have be challenged on that, but ultimately you have it's a ballot access problem, and the state is holding a primary open to everyone, and under state law advancing the top two. Louisiana system has presumably not been challenged or has been upheld. I'm not exactly sure of the legal reasoning that the state gets to override the party in this case if the party is objecting to it. But the party, I suppose, could say whichever candidate got more is our favored candidate, and then the other one would drop out or something like that. That would obviously be counter to the rationale of doing this. But the other group that would be disfavored by this are the smaller parties, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, and so forth, socialist parties, because they would have their candidates running in the primary when there's relatively little visibility, and then they would be eliminated, and not have it, have the opportunity to be on the ballot and take part in the November election when there's tremendous interest and tremendous obviously with a lot of the smaller parties, their goal is to get out there and be visible and to put out their philosophy and so forth, and they would lose their opportunity to do this under the plan.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show here on 89.1 WEMU, and today we are talking about presidential politics, caucuses, primaries, and my guest is Washtenaw County Clerk Larry Kestenbaum. I made sort of the partisan argument a minute ago. Let me make the independent voter argument, which is all of these decisions, or many of these decisions, are going to be made in the primary. And so if I can't participate in the primary, let's say we have a heavily Democratic or a heavily Republican district, and everybody understands whomever wins that party primary is going to be the winner in November, and I say I can't participate in that primary because I don't want to share my political views, it isn't fair for me to then have essentially a vote without power in November. Is that a legitimate argument to make?
Well, that's certainly an argument that is made by independents, that you're especially as we have the phenomenon of, you know, blue counties getting bluer, red counties getting redder, that we have a polarization that's happening geographically as well. And so increasingly you have congressional seats, legislative seats, and other kinds of offices being where the primary is tantamount to election.
Our congressional district, for example,
yes.
Here in
for example, yes, our congressional district, which is overwhelmingly Democratic, but the concept of that independents have a role in this. For example, one of the things that has been accomplished through that argument is the notion that you shouldn't have to have a party affiliation to get on the ballot. So Michigan for many years did not provide any way for an independent to get the ballot. The only way to be nominated to be on the ballot in a partisan race such as president or Congress was to organize a party and be nominated by the party. John Anderson in 1980 wanted to be on Michigan ballot as an independent, and they said, nope, you can't be an independent. So he organized a party called the Anderson Coalition, which held a convention and nominated, guess what, him. And that was John Anderson's route to the ballot. But the decisions since then have basically struck down the rule against independent candidates in Michigan. And until Michigan modified its law, basically all you had to do to get on the ballot was to go to a court and say, order me, you know, to be on the ballot. And finally the Secretary of State said, don't even bother to sue, just let us know, we'll put you on the ballot. So finally the legislature had to come up with a way for, deadlines and numbers of signatures and so forth required to be on the ballot as an independent.
When do we see the shift from sort of smoke-filled rooms to primaries? I mean, do we have presidential primaries in the 1800s? Did we have it in the early 1900s? Where do we begin to see primaries becoming an important method for choosing nominees?
Well, the primary started in the Progressive Era before World War I in the early 20th century. But basically, the focus up to that point was very much, when you talk getting to presidential politics, on the convention. You know, people would show up at the convention, and you'd start to see in these conventions how different each state party was. The party would get together at a national level really only every 4 years, and would discover how little it agreed on anything. Typically, but that, for example, Al Smith went to the 1924 Democratic Convention, where nearly half the delegates, wanted to support the Ku Klux Klan, the other half, these kinds of things. But there's over time, there got to be, the notion, like I said, starting in the Progressive Era, presidential primaries were instituted in many states at that time. But they weren't taken very seriously. Often they were what we call beauty contests. They didn't really have any impact on delegates, or they were people would run in these primaries without really meaning to run for president. And they would have the so-called favorite son candidates. So the governor of Ohio would be on the ballot in Ohio as a presidential candidate just to collect the delegates and have control of them when it came to the convention. And things like that. So given the lack of seriousness that people were taking this, ultimately Michigan and a lot of other states abolished the presidential primary they used to have up until the 20s and went back to allowing the parties to figure out how to allocate delegates on their own. Presidential primaries came back starting in 72 when the new party rules adopted by the Democratic Party designed to encourage greater participation, and there were a lot of exacting rules about representation, and the easiest way to comply with these rules was to just have a primary.
Mm-hmm. Now, nowadays, we have these mega primaries. They have these days where a number of states, Super Tuesday, a number of states will be having their primary at the same time. There also are people who advocate that we should have a national primary day where all of the primaries are taking place at the same time. Are there pros and cons from your perspective as a clerk and someone who administers elections? Are there good things about this in terms of participation? Are there bad things?
Well, if we had a national primary, the big objection to the national primary is that in order to be competitive in a national primary, you have to be someone who is already well-known and has a huge amount of money to be able to campaign nationally. So there really wouldn't be, there wouldn't be any question about who the nominee would be. And in fact, the primary wouldn't be about anything unless there were multiple candidates who had those characteristics.
So you couldn't build momentum. In other words, you couldn't
that's
build.
Right.
Rick Santorum, for example,
yes.
Comes up from behind in Iowa, does very well. The likelihood is if everybody was voting on the same day, he probably would not be able to do that.
That's right. And so I think there's also certainly this is what we're accustomed to in this country, is to have a period of time where the candidates go through a number of contests and give the opportunity for people to see how they function under different in different constituencies and so forth. And the New Hampshire primary and the Iowa caucuses have been one of those places where voters get to meet the candidates one-on-one and very often surprise pundits and so forth by the choices that they make. For a long time, it was said that no one had ever been elected president without winning the New Hampshire primary. Well, Bill Clinton changed that. But usually seen as a bad sign for you if you were expected to win and then you lost the New Hampshire primary, like Harry Truman in 1952 or Lyndon Johnson in 1968. So there's a lot to be said in that respect for having the primary spread out and starting out with something relatively small.
And a small state where retail politics.
Retail politics, absolutely. But the system we have is it's always the same state.
Let's talk about that in just a minute. But I want to remind listeners that this is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU. And we are talking about presidential primaries, caucuses, presidential elections in general. And my guest is Washtenaw County Clerk Larry Kestenbaum. Now, Rush Limbaugh gave his perspective on the Iowa caucuses when he said, "It's a glorified straw poll." I'm not putting it down. Don't misunderstand. I think it's one of the greatest marketing schemes ever, which brings us into another whole arena about the value of being first, the value in terms of public attention, the value in terms of the economic goose that these two states enjoy. Why do they get to be the first? The first primary, New Hampshire, the first caucus, Iowa. Surely there are other states chomping at the bit to take these positions.
Absolutely. And they still hold those positions by virtue of tradition more than anything else, and by fighting tooth and nail to keep those positions. Obviously, the smaller the state and the more the attention, the bigger the economic boost that all this provides. All the reporters and all the candidates and everyone else on the hangers-on coming to your state to camp out and spend, in some cases, months campaigning Paying for ads on your local media outlets and so forth.
And hotel rooms and food.
Absolutely.
And
all
parties
those things.
And all those kinds of things.
And New Hampshire and Iowa get 50% of the coverage of the entire primary process.
Well, there have been a couple of insurgencies.
Yes.
Michigan certainly was one of them in 2008.
And
now
Florida.
Florida. And Florida's talking about it again,
yes.
I believe. So how have the parties kept those other states in line?
Well, the parties control the process through the national party rules. And the hammer that the parties have is, if you don't follow the rules, we won't let you sit at our convention. And so the two parties took different approaches to this. The Republican Party said, if you put your primary out there or your caucus out there before a date when you're allowed to do it, you will get a 50% penalty. You'll only get to seat half your delegates. In the Democratic side, the penalty was the death penalty. You get to seat none of your delegates. And perhaps predictably, the Republicans held to that. The Michigan and Florida having broken the schedule, having broken the rules, and having their contests earlier, Michigan and Florida had a 50% reduction in delegates, and that's the way it was. In the on the Democratic side, of course, by the time the convention came around, the nomination was no longer in question, and so of course someone made a motion. Okay, let's just seat Michigan and Florida. All in favor say aye. They were seated. So it turned out to not really be very meaningful.
So do these two states have sort of, I don't want to say insiders, do they have advocates on the national level in both of their parties? In other words, certainly Michigan has some heavy hitters on the national leadership of both of these parties.
Oh, absolutely. And there are a lot of critics of New Hampshire and Iowa as not being representative states, although both of them, I guess, are now swing states. But in particular, the South feeling left out of this process, it was the Southern states that came up with Super Tuesday. And the original idea of Super Tuesday was to have a lot of Southern states all voting on the same day to be a big you say delegate prize that no party could really ignore, no candidate could ignore, and so therefore it would draw the attention of the candidates to issues that were of concern in those states, and as opposed to, I mean, obviously the states that have a lot of influence in this process managed to get their issues considered very, very.
Well, that brings another issue. I read something the other day, which is if you go into Iowa in advance of the election of the caucuses, it's all farm subsidies all the time.
Yeah.
In other words, the interests, the issues of those two states become preeminent. In the debate.
That's right.
Also, the argument is that because there's relatively low turnout in Iowa, for example, factions have tremendous impact. This year it seems to be the Tea Party and the so-called value voters.
Yes.
Their issues, their concerns have already taken over the debate there. I mean, would some of that be dissipated if we had different states going first, year after year?
Obviously, that would tend to spread it around more. With the importance of ethanol subsidies is very much attributable to Iowa's position in the presidential caucuses, but the cautionary thing is that it's not always the states that go first which decide things. Sometimes you get further along in the process before the nomination is really settled, and the states that waited until to the middle or even to the end have a much greater role. I certainly remember, now this is when under a very old schedule, now the California primary used to be in June. It used to be almost at the end of the process, but it was winner take all, and it was a huge, and still is a huge state, and so the California would end up having to a very large extent, the power to, if there were two candidates left, California would choose which one of them would be nominated.
And it's funny because, as you remember, in the 2008 election, Hillary Clinton made reference to that, that California had previously gone in June, that the primaries had gone on longer, and several people tried to argue that she was making a reference to the assassination of Senator Kennedy and somehow advocating for that. But I think people do, in fact, forget how long the process went on.
Yeah. And so with the process, the more, as they call it, front-loaded. In other words, the earlier, as every state feels that they have an incentive to have their primary or their caucus earlier, the process basically moves from having started in March originally to now in February and now even January, the beginning of January. There was some possibility at one point that New Hampshire could put their primary in December of the previous year, but the effect of it is that the decisions are being made in a big hurry at a long distance from the actual election and before a whole lot of voters have really tuned in to the fact that this is going on.
My guest is Washtenaw County Clerk Larry Kestenbaum, who in his other life also maintains the popular blog Political Graveyard. Before we went on break, Larry, we were talking about whether or not these early primaries matter. We certainly had a situation where people do well in the primary in the caucuses and then don't necessarily do well after that. Mike Huckabee wins big, gets no momentum, gets no push out of it, now is a Fox commentator. Historically, do these early events matter? Does it matter who wins in Iowa? Does it matter who wins in New Hampshire?
Well, again, to some extent, it's a matter of perception. And until Bill Clinton lost the New Hampshire primary in 92 and went on to win the nomination of the presidency, it was the folklore, the revered fact that no one had ever won the presidency since they had started having primaries. No one had won the presidency without first winning New Hampshire. Well, I think that these primaries may not have the power anymore to coronate people, but they certainly do have had the power of getting people out of the race, of killing off candidacies, in some case, someone will do poorly in Iowa or New Hampshire, and then their money dries up, and they have a great incentive to just give up. At that point,
certainly we see Michelle Bachmann has announced.
Yes.
Rick Perry is licking his wounds, but is probably likely to withdraw.
Yeah.
What about somebody like Rick Santorum? He sort of was an asterisk candidate, and then he started, his support began to grow as the sort of anti-Romney. When we see that sort of surprise winner in Iowa, have people been able to build upon that, or is it seen as sort of a blip?
Well, it's really varied. I mean, Jimmy Carter came out of Iowa as a big surprise to everyone, and went on to win everything, but it's certainly not always happened. I would say that Iowa has done more to kill Iowa and New Hampshire together have done more to kill off candidates than to really launch them. But a launch is a possible thing, and certainly they have candidates who might not otherwise be competitive become competitive by proving themselves in that in that race and in those races. I think that Santorum is certainly he's getting a lot more money now that he's the word surge really just draws the money in, and it's sort of amusing to me that each one of these candidates each had their moment in the sun.
Their surge.
And Santorum was the one which was the best timed.
Right, timing is everything.
Yes.
How much do regional politics play into this? In other words, you have Iowa that happens every 4 years, and people try very much to have connections. And sometimes we say, well, so and so is from a state right next to Iowa; he's likely to be favored. Paul Tsongas, many years ago, running for president from Massachusetts. Oh, Mitt Romney now also.
Yes.
From Massachusetts. This prediction that they're going to do well in essentially a neighborhood kind of
or Ed Muskie election. In Maine next to New Hampshire.
Yes,
yeah.
Does that actually play itself out? Is there statistically or sort of historically a benefit to people who are near?
I don't know statistically, but there have been times when Again, the perception is that the person is going to be strong there, and so that to an extent, I think candidates backed off from putting too much into New Hampshire because it was assumed it would be dominated by Mitt Romney, which so far it has. It has not played out in some of the other mentioned things you had. For example, Tim Pawlenty coming from Massachusetts.
From Minnesota.
I'm sorry. He ended up dropping out before the caucuses because he wasn't getting the support in Iowa. Having dominated the campaign scene in Iowa, he was not dominating the votes. He lost a straw poll, and so he completely dropped out of the race. The Missouri congressman
Gephardt,
yes, mm-hmm. Who's again from the state just south of Iowa, or Michelle Bachmann, who apparently was born or grew up in Iowa, even though she's a congressperson now from Minnesota. Those connections didn't count for much.
Well, and people seem to really stretch to try and make those connections. You know, I used to spend every summer with my fourth cousin twice removed in Iowa, and those are important memories to me.
Well, but any politician, you get in front of a crowd of Lutherans, and you say, well, my great grandfather was Lutheran.
exactly. Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU. We are talking with Washtenaw County Clerk Larry Kestenbaum today about primaries, caucuses, and presidential elections in general. Now, New Hampshire sort of has a reputation as a haven for insurgents, not just in politics. We've got Ron Paul moving into there, Pat Buchanan several
yes.
years ago. What about that reputation? Is it well earned?
Well, I think that there's because it's a small state, it's a state that that thinks of itself as being fiercely independent, and they the license plate saying "Live free or die," and insurgents. One of the reasons why we have the process that we do, and that we've come to value the small states as having giving an opportunity to someone who might not be as well funded. Is because of New Hampshire's tendency to not necessarily go with the flow, the conventional wisdom, as it seemed, whether it's Eugene McCarthy, Buchanan, as you mentioned, or Estes Kefauver, people there, feeling their power, feeling like that they had a chance to upset the apple cart, and very often they have taken that opportunity and not gone with what everyone was saying they're going to do. I think that, too, when you talk about a place like New Hampshire, where there's only two congressional districts, there's a limited number of primary voters, and I'm sure that the pollsters just pull the hell out of them. I mean, mm-hmm. The people getting called constantly. I would question, how good those polls get to be after people are, it's Gallup again. Don't even answer the phone. You look at the caller ID. Mm-hmm. The fact that the poll results sometimes are a long way away from predicting the outcome. For example, when unexpectedly Hillary Clinton won
right.
the New Hampshire primary over Obama, when Obama was expected to walk away with it, it was again a case of New Hampshire defying expectations. But it was also, I think, to an extent, a polling failure.
Well, now we've had the Iowa caucuses. We're headed toward New Hampshire. Tea Party influence in both areas, a more conservative primary audience in the Republican arena. How are candidates, or can candidates, pivot from these early, very conservative, many value voters kinds of participants? Can they then pivot later on to more independent or more moderate states, or into a general election after these primaries have pushed them so far to the edges of their party?
Well, certainly the candidates try to do that, and with some success in the past. I think that with the popularity of sites like YouTube and the fact that video out there can be rapidly disseminated and shared, and the shows such as The Daily Show, which basically will use past videos of people taught to show that they've changed their position, or you know, to illustrate you know, hypocrisy on a particular issue. You know, those kinds of things are making it a lot more difficult for someone to reinvent himself in the middle of the campaign.
You know, the wisdom about going to war in Russia was you always had to watch out for General Winter. both of these events take place in the winter, in places where it can be very cold and very nasty. Does the weather play a role in the outcome of these?
Well, you know, the when touring, you know, like opera companies and so forth, they come to Minnesota, to Minneapolis, and they see that there's a blizzard outside and say, well, we might as well cancel our performance. Oh, no, people will show up, and they do.
And they do.
And that people who live in places where it's cold and snow, obviously like Michigan, are accustomed to it and deal with it. And I don't think that that snow and cold weather keep people away from the polls in New Hampshire or Iowa. I think that if an ice storm might interfere, just because of the practicalities of moving around, but if it was a blizzard in Texas, well, you might as well call off the election, okay? I think that weather does affect the turnout to an extent, but when people are motivated, they're going to show up. If it's an election that people are very lightly motivated about, like, I don't know, maybe a school board election or a gubernatorial election, and the there's any difficulty with the weather, yeah, some people will not show up. But in a presidential election, and certainly in November, even your presidential election, I don't think that weather plays that much of a role at all.
Now, one of the things that we heard a lot about as in the days coming up to Iowa is that because it's retail politics there, because everybody in Iowa practically meets every candidate in the same way in New Hampshire, that you can have sort of supporter zeal overcome money. And the candidate that this gets used as an example is Ron Paul. That maybe he doesn't have a lot of money, but his supporters are so zealous in their support for him that in these small states you can in fact you can catapult from an active support base even without money. Historically, does that seem to play out?
Well, I think that that having an active zealous supporter is worth having an activist is worth 10 or 20 supporters. But and so certainly if you have that, it's an advantage, you know, over someone who doesn't have it. But there is an extent to which you can't really get that far away from where a party is going, and with the process structured the way it is, let's say Ron Paul had won the Iowa caucuses. And it's not so much just that Iowa is a small state or a relatively small state, but that Iowa, there's a relatively small participation of only like 100,000, 200,000 people voting in the caucuses, as opposed to the millions of people who live in Iowa. I mean, that's
right.
When it becomes a matter of voluntary participation and a small number of people volunteering to participate, having people who are really zealous and frenzied and really want to support you, makes a huge advantage. When you're talking about, you know, a place that is where there's a significant turnout, and even New Hampshire, let alone in places like Pennsylvania or New York, where it's really a lot more diffuse in terms of what people in Philadelphia have no idea what's going on in Pittsburgh and vice versa, and so it's a lot harder to get together that sort of critical mass to really create an insurgency that would really go anywhere.
And I mean, I don't know that we can underestimate the effect of money in all of this, though it doesn't look like having money will necessarily
right.
move you forward, but not having it is going to be a real impediment.
Right. My view has always been that the independent role of money is vastly overrated, but the money flows to people who are winning, and that's it reinforces what was already happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, Larry, I want to thank you for being the guest with me today. It's always fun to talk with you.
Well, thank you. I'm always glad to be here.
Okay. That was Washtenaw County Clerk Larry Kestenbaum. Please join me next week for another edition of The Lynn Rivers Show, when we'll talk about the news, politics, history, or a mixture thereof. Radio that makes you think. The Lynn Rivers Show, right here on 89.1 WEMU.